weekend. I'm Ellie Swain Ballard, class of 95, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to Martha Saxton, professor of history and women and gender studies and breastreader. Today, she will be speaking to us on incarceration, voting, and human rights. In addition to those who are sitting here in Stern Auditorium for this lecture, we are joined by more than 80 alumni and parents by phone or computer as part of our virtual lecture series. Professor Saxton joined the faculty at Amherst in 1996. She received her PhD from Columbia University and her BA from the University of Chicago. She's teaching the following courses this semester: Antebellum Culture, North and South, U.S. Wars, Korea to Afghanistan, Politics and Writing, 1950 to 2012, and Women's History, America, 1607 to 1865. She's also currently working on a forthcoming book, The Widow Washington. Her teaching, like her research, focuses on women's history and gender, though as you can see from her courses, she integrates her other interests into her teaching, including colonial North America and the U.S. up to the Civil War, the Old South, and African American and Native American history. Her work is truly interdisciplinary. She has taught in women and gender studies, political science, environmental studies, and history. Most recently, she's developed a course on human rights with her colleague Amrita Basu in Political Science Department, which introduces human rights to students through its history, its evolving philosophy, including critiques, and through case studies of activism and work in the field. Her lecture today draws on her course and experience with teaching historical perspectives on the criminal justice system, which was taught at the Hampshire County Jail with inmates and Amherst students enrolled in the course. After Professor Saxton's remarks, we will take questions from the audience, both in Stern and via the webinar. For those joining by computer, please type a question into the question box. You may need to expand the control panel to the right of your screen. Professor Saxton will repeat questions from the audience in Stern so those joining remotely can hear. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you, Ellie. And thank you so much for coming today. As Ellie said, I want to speak about disenfranchisement of men and women around the country who have been convicted of a felony. At the moment, we have about 5.6 million people, former felons who can't, either felons or former felons who can't vote. This includes the 2.2 million people who are in jail, but also those who are under some form of state or federal surveillance, either on probation or parole, or people who simply haven't been able to pay their fees and fines associated with their incarceration. I became interested in this issue several years ago when I began teaching in the Inside Out program in the Northampton Jail. I have taught both a history of criminal justice in there and also a modification, sort of a modified version of the course that I worked on with Amrita Basu here for in the college, so I've also taught a course on human rights inside. And as Ellie said, the format is to bring 12 Amherst students or 12 five college students in, and we work for a semester meeting once a week with 12 incarcerated students. And the discussions are really quite extraordinary. When I taught the human rights course, we of course discussed the Declaration at great length. And students were immensely interested, particularly in the guarantees against racial and religious discrimination, and its guarantees of education and political participation. I taught in the fall of 2008. That was, I think, the second time I taught one of those courses, which was, of course, an election year. And I was very, very struck by how interested the inmates, how closely they followed the election, how interested they were in and kept up on the candidates, and how much they wanted to vote. And although I think the prevailing myth about people on the inside is that they will all come out and vote Democratic, this was absolutely not not the case in the small sample that I witnessed. They couldn't vote in Massachusetts, although before 2000 they would have been able to. In 2000, Massachusetts had a referendum to disfranchise felons, although it does restore their rights as soon as they are out of jail or prison. Before that, before 2000, Massachusetts had stood with Vermont and Maine as the one of the only three states that did not disfranchise people, even when they were in prison. Massachusetts, oddly, went against this kind of liberalizing trend when it voted in 2000 to deny voting rights to people inside. States, as you probably know, have extremely divergent policies on this issue. In Virginia and Kentucky and Florida, you can never vote once you've been convicted of a felony unless the governor issues clemency, which is very hard to get and takes a very long time to enact. Laws in eight states prohibit voting for the rest of felons or ex-felons' lives for certain categories of crimes. 35 states prohibit people on parole or probation from voting. In some states, you can apply for the right to be restored to you, sometimes on release, other times you have to wait 2 to 5 years. In the recent liberalizing trend, 23 states have streamlined restoration of rights or shortened the wait to begin the process. These provisions actually can change very rapidly depending on who's in control of a state legislature or the governor. As the governor changes. Florida is a good example. Actually, Florida is a good example of almost anything in terms of voting rights. Under the Democratic governor, Lawton Chiles, ex-felons were allowed to vote. Under his successor, Jeb Bush, the prohibition on felony voting was enforced. Under Charlie Crist, the Democrat, voting rights were restored to those who were no longer under the surveillance of the court, so once after parole. But under the current governor, Scott, many of those people got letters saying that they really weren't eligible to vote and that the felony prohibition has been reinstated in Florida, as you probably know. In the elections upcoming, I'm sure there'll be dramatic changes again in these various provisions. Because of the disproportionate number of African Americans in prison, disfranchisement affects them at a rate 7 times that of other American men. An estimated 1.4 million African American men in Florida can't vote. Given current rates of incarceration, 3 in 10 of the next generation of black men across the country can expect to be disenfranchised at some point in their lifetime. In New York, 80% of the people who are disfranchised are black. In states that disfranchise all ex-offenders, as many as 40% of black men may permanently lose their right to vote, as in Florida. This obviously has an effect on our electoral system. Studies have shown that disfranchisement has probably been decisive in as many as 7 senatorial elections, and of course it was arguably conclusive in the 2000 presidential election in Florida. Another issue that is less discussed is that incarcerated men and women are generally counted in states for the purpose of apportioning representation, although they usually don't come from the districts in which they're imprisoned. And increasingly, they don't even necessarily come from the states in which they're serving their sentences. Like the use of the death penalty and the lengthy use of prison sentences, we are on the repressive end of the global spectrum with regard to criminal justice. Some countries, like the Scandinavian ones, as well as France, Switzerland, Ireland, South Africa, Israel, and perhaps less predictably Pakistan, Iran, Ukraine, Serbia, and Bangladesh, do not curtail the right to vote, either in prison or later. At least constitutionally, this is in practice on the ground, it doesn't always necessarily work out according to the letter of the Constitution. A large majority of countries disqualify some prisoners for small number of selected crimes. These countries include, these are just sort of a few examples. The list, if you're interested in the list, I can give you the article to go and look them up. But in the meantime, I'm just listing some countries. In any case, those countries that disqualify some prisoners for a small number of selected crimes include the Netherlands, Spain, and Zimbabwe. Usually the more serious the crime, the more likely the vote will be taken away. In China, for example, prisoners on death row cannot vote, and in Lesotho, prisoners on death row and also those serving a life sentence can't vote. In Germany, those convicted of voter fraud, which makes a certain kind of terrific logic, can't vote. While in Turkey, those convicted of, quote, ideological or anarchistic activities are disfranchised. Some countries don't allow prisoners to vote, but they don't restrict their access after they get out of jail, after they've served their sentences. And these include the UK, Kazakhstan, Nigeria, Uruguay, Russia, India, and Venezuela. The fourth group, which includes the US and seven other countries, has the most restrictive practices and prohibits inmates from voting, but also voting after, in many cases, after release. They include Cameroon and Chile that prohibit voting for 10 years, and a couple of Finland and New Zealand do it for 7 years, and I think Philippines does it for 5 years. The reason that this issue is so important in the United States is because we have a gigantic number of people in jail or who have been in and out of the system. As I said, we have something like 2.2 million people in prison. And as critics of the system keep saying, we have 25% of the world's prisoners and only 5% of the world's population. One major reason for the large number of incarcerated people is Reagan's war on drugs, which, while it certainly hasn't apparently slowed the sale or use of drugs, it has filled our jails. The war on drugs encouraged states to create new kinds of crimes, like selling drugs near a school, which would increase somebody's sentence by some 2 to 5 years, depending on what state you live in. And, of course, encouraging states to pass the three strikes laws, which have imprisoned people with very, very long sentences for combinations of sometimes very minor infractions, like violating parole, driving without a license, shoplifting. That added on to another pair of crimes can put you in for decades. Michelle Alexander, who the author of The New Jim Crow, as well as a lot of other scholars, have described how the drug laws target African-American communities, although African-Americans use drugs at no higher rates than any other Americans. And the accompanying disfranchisement of affects African-Americans disproportionately, as I said. Approximately 60% of the people in jail are racial or ethnic minorities. 7 times the number of African-Americans than whites have lost the right to vote. As an historian, I was actually fascinated to see that we did something very similar during Prohibition. Lawmakers passed three strikes laws. They increased certain kinds of the sentencing on certain kinds of crimes. And there was generally a crackdown on a tough-on-crime kind of policy that filled our prisons to a dangerous level, and overcrowding was, you know, just one of the things that was that worried people. There were some really important differences. The incarcerated were not disproportionately men of color. The actual numbers were much, much smaller. And the tough-on-crime rhetoric and policies lasted about a decade rather than more than three, as they have in our case. And, of course, Prohibition was repealed. But problems of men serving excessively long sentences, often for relatively insignificant crimes, overcrowding of prisons, and rising costs were the same as those that we suffer now. Roosevelt's administration, when he came into office, changed those policies early on, and the numbers of people in jail went back to what was considered a kind of a normal number and remained at that percentage of the population till, as I said, the early 1970s, when the tough-on-crime policies and drug policies began to fill our prisons again. In these decades, politicians have seen very little downside in being tough on crime. And this time, a new industry has risen. Private prison builders and contractors have profited economically from the growing numbers of incarcerated. But it does look now as if many states, particularly the big incarcerators like Texas and California and New York, are trying to slow down this kind of gigantic imprisoning machine because they simply don't have the money to keep fueling it. So that's the kind of basic landscape of felony disenfranchisement. And I thought it would be useful to look at some of the theories that support it and some that challenge it. I'm a civilian in this field. I'm not a political scientist. So my arguments are such as they are those of somebody who's just read a bunch on this, and I'd love to hear what you think afterwards when we discuss this. I think the major argument in favor of disenfranchisement is the case that in liberal society, felons have broken the social contract, and having done so, can't be trusted to participate in society again. Roger Clegg argues that we don't allow children or insane people to vote, and felons he finds in a similar category. As he says, quote, we have certain minimum standards of trustworthiness before we let people participate in the serious business of self-government. And people who commit serious crimes don't meet those standards. Those who agree with this point of view argue variously that felons are not trustworthy voters, that they're not loyal to the nation, and that felons would fraudulently interfere with the voting process if they were allowed to vote. That felons have broken the social contract, it seems to me, is debatable and depends, I think, on what felony you're charged with to some degree. Treason would probably count, I imagine, as breaking the social contract. But it's hard to argue that possession or use of marijuana breaks the social contract. But in both cases, and I don't have a very a fixed position on how we should fix this situation, so I'm just moving around hypothetically here. I think it's hard to argue in either case that people in jail, I mean, I think you can argue, make the case that people in jail maybe shouldn't vote. But I think that in a liberal democracy, we do feel that once you've done the time, you've served, you've paid your proverbial debt to society, and you should be, your rights should be restored. So while restricting the vote to prisoners, I think can be argued, and possibly could be argued for treason for a lifetime, it's hard to see its validity after a man or woman has served his or her sentence. Another argument is that ex-felons who vote might create a voting bloc and make neighborhoods unsafe by voting law and order sheriffs and other officials out of office. There is absolutely no evidence whatever that ex-felons have ever banded together to vote in any coordinated fashion. Indeed, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that ex-felons are one of those groups that's very unlikely to vote at all. So that argument doesn't seem to bear a lot of weight. Also, it's explicitly illegal to prevent people from voting based on some prediction of how they will vote. However, the argument that permanently disfranchises people guilty of voter fraud, as they do in Germany, might make sense in that context, since the punishment does seem congruent with the crime, as it does not in most of the other cases. In my view, the loyalty of felons to the nation is rarely a question, unless, again, the conviction is for treason. Stealing a car, forging a check, drunken driving, they don't seem to me to have any relationship to whether or not one is loyal to the United States. So I think it makes little sense to disfranchise based on that argument. Another argument for taking away the vote is that in our democracy we have, quote, a right to collective self-determination and should be able to decide how we want our society to function. This is a less common argument for disfranchisement than the social contract argument, and it depends on seeing democracy as majoritarian rule, something we have built in constitutional protections against. Women probably wouldn't have been granted the vote if we were strictly a majoritarian society. Maybe now they would, but certainly in 1920, I doubt it. Even so, if we were a direct majoritarian society, several studies have showed that about 80% of Americans, according to one study, think felons should have the right to vote once they get out. So that argument doesn't seem to work either way you use it. Related to the broken social contract argument, some have argued that disfranchisement is just a legitimate aspect of punishment, and it's just should be part of the criminal justice, the punitive aspect of criminal justice. Now, there are four reasons usually that we think of to put people in jail. First, there's retribution. There's incapacitating offenders. There's deterring further crime. And the fourth is to rehabilitate people who have committed some sort of crime. Now, incapacitation is accomplished by putting people in jail, whether they vote or not. You know, incapacitation is in no way diminished by people voting. Losing the right to vote as a deterrent really seems kind of crazy to me. I mean, I can't imagine if I was about to steal a car thinking, oh my God, I'm going to lose the right to vote if I steal this car. And it seems as if the death penalty itself is not a proven deterrent, so it is hard to imagine that voting would act that way. Now, retribution and rehabilitation are historically in tension with each other in this country, and we sort of go back and forth in different historical periods about what we think about, what we emphasize, the one or the other. Retribution has been dominant in criminal justice philosophy for the last 3 or 4 decades. Disenfranchisement for life or for an extended period after prison usually, however, has nothing to do with the kind of crime committed, and therefore seems to be both disproportionate and arbitrary as a punishment, even if you think that retribution is a philosophy that a liberal democracy should embrace when punishing people. In favor of leaving prisoners, or anyway, ex-offenders, the right to vote, is one extremely practical, I mean, there are a number of philosophical reasons, but there's one quite practical reason, which is that exercising the franchise does seem to have a rehabilitative effect on people. Losing it is one of a very significant array of losses that formerly incarcerated people face on trying to reenter society. Coming out with a record, of course, makes it incredibly hard to get a job. You're also disbarred from many of society's benefits, like social, welfare programs and subsidized housing and so on. And given that most of the 2.2 million men and women on the inside will be coming out at some point, it seems that it would make sense to try to engage them in society's constructive experiences and positive responsibilities as quickly as possible. A number of studies show that ex-offenders who vote have lower recidivism rates. One study based on interviews with self-reported felons between 1997 and 2000 showed that 27% of non-voters were rearrested, while only 12% of the voters were. This is a little bit of a side issue, but one quite disturbing study shows that simply having run-ins with the criminal justice system, even ones that don't end up in jail, tend to alienate people from the government and from civic participation. And that's part of another conversation, but it is, I think, quite a disturbing comment on how jail and the threat of jail affect citizens. In any case, studies bear out that the not very surprising conclusion that the stigma attached to not being able to vote loosens the bonds between citizen and community, while voting tightens them. In addition to the fact that we are, as a nation, outliers among other nations on the policy of disenfranchisement, that it's a violation of our citizens' human rights to participate in the political process, and that in any case it doesn't make a lot of sense, except in response to very specific crimes, I think that the history and development of the practice should make us suspicious of continuing it. I am a historian, although I'm not a political science, but I'm a scientist, but I am a historian, and so I tend to believe that it's really important, the origins of our policies, and we should know what they are when we evaluate them. Historically, there were two big pushes for felon disenfranchisement. The first was in the northern states in the 1840s, and it came exactly at the same time that there was a big push to remove property requirements from voting and so enlarge the vote enormously. By making this very grand opening of the vote to men, of course not women, they disenfranchised felons as a way to sort of keep tabs on what they considered the undesirables and try to control this experiment in enlarged democracy. Since this happened mostly in the north, in the northern and western states, this had no particular racial impact because it was only in the northeast, in New England, and in a couple of states near New England that free blacks could vote in any case. The next wave of disfranchisement occurred throughout the South after the Civil War and Reconstruction, and it spread to other parts of the country. And of course, it did have a huge impact on on race and on African Americans. In the South and elsewhere, disfranchisement was one of a number of ways to keep African Americans from the polls. And these devices became more widespread and included more and more infractions over the decades as it became clear that the federal government wasn't going to interfere in any of these policies at the state level. The South disenfranchised some whites along with these policies and increasing the definitions of crime. But increasingly, blacks made up larger and larger numbers of prisoners, or rather gangs of convicted and leased laborers, because the South didn't have very many prisons after the Civil War. In Alabama, for example, about 2% of the convict population in 1850 was black, but with emancipation, 74% of the convict population was black in 1870, and that's before Jim Crow starts to really do its work. Alabama enlarged definitions of crime and applied them almost exclusively to black people. So, for example, it made larceny, which is not necessarily a felony, an offense that triggered disenfranchisement in 1875 and made it applicable retroactively, citing the state's need to preserve the purity of the ballot box. The 1901 Alabama Constitution included moral turpitude as a reason for losing the vote. This provision survived until the Supreme Court struck it down in 1985 because of the extreme racial bias with which it was employed. Most of these disenfranchisement regulations stood until the 1970s. This was a moment when prisoners initiated a wave of litigation to reform their circumstances. It was also the same time that tough-on-crime policies began to sort of warm up and the current phase of hyper-incarceration began. In 1974, a suit from the prisoners' rights movement challenged felony disenfranchisement nationally. The plaintiffs argued that, among other things, that felony disenfranchisement had to serve some kind of compelling state interest. Otherwise, it should be subject to high scrutiny, as were all other voting restrictions. The California Supreme Court agreed with this, but William Rehnquist did not, and so the Supreme Court, in a divided decision, let felony disenfranchisement stand. Since then, the court has largely refused to hear cases challenging disenfranchisement, although it actually asked then Solicitor Elena Kagan in 2010 to explain the administration's beliefs on this issue, so it seems to be interested in taking up this issue again. A recent challenge came from Massachusetts, arguing that the referendum 10 years ago violates the Voting Rights Act because of its disproportionate impact on African Americans. But the Massachusetts court decided that prisoners were not, Voting Rights Act didn't apply to prisoners. There's also a case in the Ninth Circuit called Farrakhan and Gregoire versus Gregoire that challenges Washington State's disenfranchisement law based on the racial disparity in that state's criminal justice system. Blacks make up 3.4% of the state's population and 24% of the prison population. 15% of Washington's black population was disfranchised. In 2009, Washington decided to restore voting rights to people who had exited the criminal justice system, even if they hadn't paid their fines and financial obligations. So the issue was settled at a state level, but the question is whether the Supreme Court will hear this or some other challenge, and if so, whether this particular court will be interested in doing anything about it, which seems somewhat unlikely, but you never know. So to finish up, the more I learned about this issue, the more it seemed to need serious rethinking for several reasons. Our policies don't make citizens safer, something criminal justice is supposed to do. They arbitrarily often punish people who have served their time and paid their debt to society. They dramatically weaken already challenged poor African American communities where large numbers of citizens can't vote and therefore have significantly less voice in shaping the policies that affect them. This in turn deepens the alienation that many of these communities feel from the larger society. And this in turn weakens our democracy and skews our elections. I don't, as I said before, I have fixed ideas about what we should do, but I think whatever we do come up with should be consistent, fair, and in keeping with our democratic values. Thank you.